Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
There could be some cultural exchange between the two coasts.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sitaro. This is episode 120, a talk with Master Ace. Duval Master Ace Clear is a rap legend whose career dates back to his time with the Juice Crew in the late 1980s. That historic rap collective, led by producer Marley Marl, included stars like Big Daddy Kane, Biz Markie, Roxanne Shanté, and Kool G Rap. Ace made his recording debut on what is arguably hip-hop's greatest posse cut, Marley Marl's The Symphony, which also featured Juice Crew members Craig G, G-Rap, and Kane. The success of that song led to Ace's debut album, 1990's Take a Look Around, which featured the comic hit Me and the Biz. After leaving Marley's orbit, Ace successfully reinvented himself with critically beloved albums like Slaughterhouse and Sittin' on Chrome, the latter of which, with its West Coast-sounding beats and songs about car culture, got him in a little bit of trouble with a few of his fellow New Yorkers, as you'll hear. After several years of industry ups and downs, Ace reinvigorated his career with the 2001 album Disposable Arts. The success of that record, and the renewed audience it brought to his live performances, led to a career upswing that has continued to this day. Ace has released numerous solo, duo, and group albums in the ensuing decade and a half, and tours heavily by himself and with his group EMC. His latest album, with EMC, is called The Tonight Show. We talked to Master Ace at Crosstown Studios in Harlem, just a few subway stops from Central Park. He had performed there this past July at a show headlined by Kane, which culminated in a full-on symphony reunion. It was there that we began our conversation. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 32, where we talk to Ace's fellow Juice Crew alum, Big Daddy Kane. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And next up, Master Ace gets on the mic for the cipher. So, you know, I was at the show at Central Park, the one you did with EMC.
Yeah.
Where Kane headlined, and you guys ended the show with a live performance of the symphony with everybody, including Marley. That was pretty nuts.
Hasn't happened that many times in history. So we've only done that record, you know, together. That would be the third time ever.
Do you remember the circumstances around the other times?
I remember the very first time. It was when Kane's album had just come out, and Long Live the Kane, and he had a show in New Jersey, Newark, at an old hip hop spot called Club Sensations, and so he actually had us all roll out to Jersey with him in his limousine, and we got on stage at Club Sensations and performed the song, and this was 1989, and this was literally like the only time we did it together on stage until last year.
Wow.
Yeah. We did it last year at the Radio City Music Hall. They had the big hip hop show there. Mm-hmm. And that was our first time doing it since the 1989 performance, all four of us on stage.
Wow. How was it to do at Central Park at Summer Stage there?
It was cool, man. It was, I did not expect that many people to be there. So that kind of caught me off guard, but I thought it was pretty awesome. It was just a good moment, you know, kind of being backstage with everybody, talking about old times a little bit. You know, I guess us all being there kind of rekindled the conversation about having a Juice Crew tour and possibly doing, you know, some shows together and stuff like that. So it was cool, man. Hopefully we get to do it a few more times.
That would be great. And there's also been rumors for years of a Juice Crew movie biopic.
The Vapors is the story of the Juice Crew, which for the most part, Marley Marl is the lead character being played by Cuba Gooding Jr., Biz Markie, Big Daddy Kane, and Roxanne Shanté. Those are the four main characters of the film, but it basically touches on the lives of everybody in the Juice Crew, individually, and how they came together as a collective and how they, you know.
Had a conversation about that as well. Marley Marl, he had gotten the ball rolling on doing, you know, that movie, and then something happened with the original director, I guess, some kind of misunderstanding, and so now they're trying to refocus and figure out a new direction for that movie. But yeah, it was in the works, and then it got shut down about 5 years ago, and I think they're trying to get it going again.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, the symphony was a crazy record for you. If I understand the story right, you didn't even know you were going to be on it until you heard it on the radio.
Well, no, it was before I heard it on the radio, but I wasn't intended to be the fourth rapper on that song.
Right.
MC Shan, who at the time was really the biggest name, was supposed to be the fourth rapper on the song. When I showed up at the studio with those guys, I was really just tagging along. You know, we went to Marley Marl's house right after we had done the photo shoot for his album, Marley Marl in Control, Volume 1. If you remember the back of that album cover, we're all standing by a Learjet. And so I was, besides Marley, I was the only other person that was driving. So
you had to be there.
I was just helping out, you know, but I really wanted to just tag along and watch those guys, you know, create. It was my first time being around Kane. He was a big influence for me as I was coming up writing. And, I was just kind of excited to see the process. So I, you know, volunteered to be the extra ride to Marley's crib in Astoria, Queens. Watch those guys write to the beat. And it wasn't until it came time for somebody to actually rap that there was hesitation among the three that were there.
Right. No one wants to go first.
Nobody wanted to go first. You know, it's that wanting to hear what everybody else has to spit before they spit. So Marley just really asked me to go in and warm the mic up, was kind of pretty much what he said. You know, go spit something, loosen these guys up. So, you know, I spit a verse that I had in my mental Rolodex. I used to walk around with about 10 to 12 memorized rhymes, and I picked one, and that happened to be that verse. I really don't believe, and he told me that he didn't initially intend to keep me on the song. It was just a way to loosen those dudes up. But when he heard the verse, and I guess there was some talk behind the scenes with him and Kane and G-Rap, and everybody liked the verse and decided to keep me on the song.
Tried to do what I did, just the way I came off. Then I'm gonna come off stronger and longer, even with the trouble. I'll keep on going and flowing.
And it was just by virtue of that conversation, they decided to keep me on the record, and you know, history was made from there for me. That launched my career.
Right, and stuff happened really quickly. I read you talking about how, you know, you'd bring Craig G to your neighborhood after the song was out.
Yeah.
And people would try to rob you and stuff.
No, not try. Nobody tried. They were, back then we called it scheming.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is they're looking, they're having a conversation to see if there's something that they want to take. What it was after that video came out, you know, everybody had on this big giant rope chains and, gold chains and everything. And, So some of the guys in my neighborhood thought that, you know, we would show up wearing the same jewelry from the video. And so they just kind of came around to see what guys were wearing. But nobody did anything. It was just like standing around looking and, you know, ice grilling, as we call it. But nobody did anything.
Right. I find this, I've heard this from other artists as well, from, you know, that period, kind of late 80s, even up through like the early into the mid 90s. People assumed that everyone they saw on TV was rich.
They did. And, you know, after the symphony video came out, like I was still taking the train, you know, the subway. And people would see me on the subway and be like, Master Ace, what you doing on the train? Like,
you're like trying to get where I'm going. Yeah. What are you doing?
We're doing the subway. like, yo, this is what it is. They just assumed if you're in a video, like you gotta have tons of money. And so yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah. So your first single was under the name, the somewhat confusing name, Ace in Action.
Yeah.
To begin, once again, my friend, yo, it's Ace in Action, here to send any and all MCs into a frenzy, cause I'll take a rapper out just like a Benzie, yeah, it's like the same
old... And Action wasn't a person.
It wasn't. It was a crew. It was, in my mind, it was a crew. It was a movement. I, for as long as I can remember, have always wanted to be associated with a group or a crew as opposed to it just being me. Back then, all of the successful acts were groups. There weren't many successful solo artists. So I didn't think that I could, you know, be successful riding on just my name. So, you know, I was trying to create a group concept. And so that's why I came up with Ace in Action. But it was super confusing and people didn't get it. And they thought it was my DJ. And,
right,
you know, to this day, people still mistakenly call Steady Pace Action. And, you know, Special Ed has a DJ back then called Action. But so there was a lot of confusion with that. But once I realized that it wasn't translating, you know, I dropped the whole Action thing. And so the first album came out as just Master Ace.
Yeah. And that first album, actually, there's a lot going on there. Lyrically, there's a ton of stuff, like a lot of kind of pretty advanced stuff. You have, you know, lots of alliteration and rhymes going over the bar line and like all kinds of crazy lyrical stuff.
So they can make a little noise and protest. Those that fuss got bus wearing no vest. I told that MC to go west. Let's see who can put on a show best. The creep that tried to sleep got no rest. I got a rap that can trap a slow pest. Where's your girl?
Were you just trying to show what you could do on that record in a way?
Yeah, that first record was literally me proving that I was a good MC to other rappers. Like, that's all that record was about. Like, I'm gonna show the world I'm dope and just trying to, you know, because when the symphony came out, you know, everybody was super excited and going crazy over Kool G Rap's verse and Big Daddy Kane's verse. And it wasn't really much conversation about me or Craig. I thought that, you know, I needed to reiterate that, yo, I'm dope and this is the kind of stuff I spit. I even went so far as to take the symphony beat and do a song called 4-3 where I rapped over that beat new lyrics.
And I don't need a black hat to be a villain. The posse is Action and the label is Cold Chillin'. The question is how hype will you get? When you heard this beat, you were familiar with a jam you heard before. This is a summary, a voice around you, but there's only one of me. Lyrics and dialect come from all angles. The cordless mic in my hand still strangles.
I was going to ask about that, because that kind of jumps out as being a little unusual since, you know, the beat was used on that, on the other song. Why'd you do that?
I did it because, you know, the day that song was done, like I said, I didn't have an opportunity to actually write a rhyme like everybody else did. I went with a rhyme that I had already had memorized. And so I wanted to kind of show the people that heard the song and thought that, you know, I was okay, but nowhere near the other Kane or G-Rap, that, you know, I could rhyme on that same level with them. And if I had an opportunity to write a rhyme to that beat, this is kind of stuff I would have wrote. And I just went for it.
Yeah. And the other thing about that album, and this is something you've expressed kind of mixed feelings about in the years afterwards, is it has, for lack of a better word, a kind of conscious feel to it.
The way I see things, life isn't fair. So I never learned how to share or to care, but to hope and hope instead of feeling down. And that's how it is on the other side of town.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. I call it preachy because that's kind of what I was in my preachy stage at that point. I had just graduated from college. I came up in, you know, Brooklyn, New York, Brownsville. Grew up in the projects, Howard Houses. And there were a lot of friends around me that had fallen by the way of jail, drugs, violence. And I basically was trying to get across the point that, you know, if I could do it, you could do it. That, you know, selling drugs, carrying guns, that wasn't the only way out of here. And so I definitely was a little more preachier on that first album. You know, I feel like all of my records have had a message and had a conscious decision to try to elevate people's thinking, but I tried to be a little bit more strategic about the way I put it together going forward with the later albums.
Sure. I mean, gun violence would obviously be a huge theme on your second and third records as well.
Yeah.
One particular song on that album that I wanted to talk about was I Gotta.
Oh, yeah.
The one Mr. C produced that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So for people who don't know that tune, it's you kind of talking back to a sample, a vocal sample.
Pick up the mic on a solo tip. Run you down like a polo skip. Rip MCs like a paper bag. Wear disguise to escape a nag. Go to my shows in a limousine, but stay in touch with my inner scene. Keep my house nice and tidy. Learn a lot about the white.
Was that the first time that you'd heard of something like that being done?
I think so. I can't point to a record before that took a phrase in a loop or a sample and the rapper rapped over that phrase, but sort of responding to that phrase, almost like a call and response. Every time the loop says, I gotta, I would make a statement. I think it was a little bit groundbreaking. And I think for those reasons, the record really blew up huge in the United Kingdom, London in particular. The record got really, really big there. There's a well-known DJ out of the UK named Tim Westwood. And when he got the record, like, he just went crazy spinning it. And, you know, my sort of fame in the UK preceded me. I didn't actually get to the UK till 91. And, when I got there, I was not expecting the overwhelming fans that loved that record and were into me as an artist because of that record. It was a big record out there. It didn't really resonate in other places, but in the UK, it was a huge record.
Interesting. How did Mr. C get involved?
C was a friend, man. Like, he DJed for Kane. We had there were a couple of tours that they had done where they were supposed to, because Kane used to travel with a pretty big entourage, security, and of course the dancers, DJ, yeah. Road manager. He used to travel with about 6 or 7 people. And there were a couple of times where one of the security people or one of the other entourage couldn't make the trip last minute. And it's so weird. I'm thinking back, that was before you had to show ID to get on a plane. Like, they had an extra ticket in this person's name and I could just board the plane as that person. This is way back in, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. So, you know, I was the choice to roll with them to Puerto Rico once and to Canada once, Toronto, to just really hang out. And, you know, Kane would call me out on stage to do my verse to the symphony. And so, you know, the bond was kind of created that way. And then, you know, me and C and some other friends, we would play, back then it was Sega Genesis, Tecmo Bowl and then later on Madden. But, you know, so we had the video game thing in common. And he was just a cool dude. Those guys embraced me and allowed me into their camp, into their fold. And so that's how the friendship, you know, initially got, you know, started. And then when it came time to work on my record, he was doing beats and he let me hear that Agata joint. I loved it, and I jumped all over it.
Interesting. And obviously that technique has been used, you know, plenty of times in the years since.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the idea of talking back to the sample. Your first, probably at least 3 records start with spoken word style pieces.
Yeah.
Take a look around and ask yourself why. See all those people on the other side of town living large and posting high. Take a look around.
As I walk through the valley of 187 land, no matter what state, what city, what town, I can see there's no place to run, no place to hide. I could be in the crosshairs of somebody, somewhere. I want to ask why.
One fine spring. Middle of May. My cousin Jerome flew in from LA. He came to spend the summer on the streets of New York, tripping on how we dress, me bugging on how he talks.
Why did you include those, and where did the influence for that kind of come from?
The inspiration came from Gil Scott-Heron, one of the many artists that my mother had in her record, her extensive vinyl collection in our apartment in the projects. And listening to that, Gil Scott-Heron, he had a song called "A Revolution Will Not Be Televised," where he just really just did a speech over this beat.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised.
I took that same beat on my first album, and I kind of did my own speech over the same music. And then after I did that, I just thought it was cool. Fans seemed to like it. So I said, every record, I'm going to try to do a similar spoken word type speech for every record. So I did it for the next three records, or next two records after that first one. It was just like, I don't know, just a cool way to express myself other than rapping. And the fans seemed to like it.
Yeah. So from there, you started recording a follow-up on Cold Chillin', spent presumably months working on it, and nothing ever happened with it.
Yeah.
What were those songs like, and did any of them or any parts of them end up on Slaughterhouse?
Some of the lyrics got recycled, some lines, but none of the songs. The songs were conscious. A lot of the samples were noisier kind of samples. You got to remember Public Enemy starting to kind of come in, and, you know, the Hit Squad had all of this noisy sounding production. And so I was trying to stay in line with that sound. But I had some really cool records. Some of them actually have been released later on. I had a song called "Can I Get a Dollar," where I'm rapping from the perspective of a homeless guy on the street.
Brother, man, can I please get a dollar for a can? A can of what? A can of beer. Listen here. No more Miller High Life.
I had a song called "Hell Up in Harlem," which was really just about revolution and you know, just not having it no more and wanting better for me and my people.
Somebody's raising some hell uptown. There's no traces, but their faces are brown. Brown young rebels in their eyes read anger. One brother stood with a hood. Ain't gonna take it no more. I had enough of this sleeping on the floor. That's what he said as he sat at the head of a table full of brothers ready and able. Not a soul.
It was a lot of records like that, definitely influenced by Public Enemy and their movement. But that album got shelved because Cold Chillin' and their relationship with Warner Brothers had reached a point where they had signed too many acts. They had signed the genius GZA, who eventually became GZA from Wu-Tang Clan. They had Granddaddy IU, they had Kid Capri, they had Diamond Shell, and this is about another two or three acts that they had signed. And basically Warner Brothers told Cold Chillin' that they had too many acts and they needed to trim the roster.
Right, and you said they drew a line, right? Above this amount of sales you stay, below it you go.
Yeah. And I was the name that fell right below that line. I was the first name right below that line. Craig G had already gone, so they kept MC Shan, Shante, Big Daddy Kane, Coogee Rap Polo, Biz Markie. That's who they kept. And everybody else got dropped.
Wow. So you end up making Slaughterhouse, one of probably, you know, I think my favorite of your records and certainly one of your most beloved. And the title track is a parody of gangster rap, basically.
Chainsaw in my holster, barbed wire rope, and I hang it like a poster. So when I grab my action, better drop, cause I'm
swing, and chop in a slaughterhouse.
Was, you know, very all over the place at the time of the record's release.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people, though, who didn't realize that song was a parody, even though you created characters actually called the Ignorant MC and MC Negro
yeah.
to rap that song, and the beat itself was kind of comic. Like, I think it was like more Bounce to the Ounce or something, yeah, right? Like the most cliche West Coast thing you can get. At what point did you realize, like, hey, people aren't really, or at least some people aren't really getting that this is a joke?
You know, when I really truly found out was I had a show in St. Louis, Missouri, and we went to a car show, and they were having like a wet t-shirt contest, and the DJ put that record on as kind of the signature record for the girls to dance to. And I'm looking at the audience and everybody's hands are in the air. Murder, 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 kill, kill, kill. Like, they were just accepting it on its face value. And I was like, wow, like, they don't at all get that this is a joke. Like,
right. You even made a mix of the song with just those two just characters them. And not yeah. the second half where it's you.
What the hell is so funny? We're platinum boy and we're making crazy money. Just what you owed it. Step this way and you're gonna get slaughtered. Welcome to the nine tray. The hardcore rap moves to the next level. This MC Negro and the NMC. And all you hip-hop is better lock your door. Because here comes the craziest.
Because that part, that record was blowing up more than the rest of the music I was doing. Like, they were about to be their own, you know. If I wonder if we had just put them out as a group commercially, they probably would have sold a million records.
Amazing. Did you do the voices for both of them? Who did the?
No. That was my man Unique from Icy Rock and my man Ice from their brothers from Icy Rock. Unique did a lot of the production on Slaughterhouse.
And, right, and was a big part of the INC crew.
And they both rapped on my song Saturday Night Live, but they played those parts. If you see the video, they got the Jerry Curl wigs and they're in the slaughterhouse with blood all over the jackets, and you know, they're walking around with chainsaws and big giant knives, and it's just like as far as you could go with murder and slaughter. And you know, I just felt like the game had reached a point where, you know, as violent as you could sound, is that's what the labels were signing and wanted to hear. And so I just took it and went super far with it. And you know, just to try to hopefully bring some people to the realization that this is not what it's about, and this is way ridiculous.
Right.
Some people got it, some people didn't. Later on, some people thought I was just trying to diss the entire West Coast, when in fact there were quite a bit of East Coast rappers that were rapping about guns and blunts and 40s and violence. And you know, it was an industry-wide thing. It wasn't a coastal thing at all.
Yeah, and in fact, it's one of the things I wanted to ask about. You know, Boom Bash, and there are a couple of things on there that were noteworthy. One of them is, at least to my ear, you take a little bit of a dig at Onyx.
Do I?
Right? You say, I slam and I slam and I slam.
Oh, nah.
No?
I don't even think, was Slam even out?
I was wondering about that, if you were conscious of that or if that song was even out at that point.
They actually thought that I took a dig at them. Mm-hmm. In a freestyle that I had done on Stretch and Bobbito, and there was like a little misunderstanding, and you know, we had a little issue at one point, a little confrontation, and you know, it got smoothed over. It was just like, yo, I literally hadn't heard of them at the time that I was doing the stuff I was doing. Like, they weren't out.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Also on that song, you have that line, you say, so what, I use Funky Drummer. Were you getting criticized for using those drums at that point?
Nah, it was just like Funky Drummer. I wasn't getting criticized, but Funky Drummer had been just really overused, like to the nth degree. And it was almost like a bad thing to use some of the breaks that people were using. But my boy Unique, actually, the way he chopped it, a one bar chop, it was Funky Drummer, but it felt different, and it was dope anyway. And you know, I never sold dope. I don't carry a nine. I ain't no hustler. The bitch is on my mind.
Gangsters are swimming in the water, but coming up short. I order boom, bash, and slaughter. I boom and I bash and I bash and I boom. Check it.
I'm just trying to just be as opposite of what the norm was as I could.
Yeah. There are a couple alternate mixes of the songs on that album.
Yeah.
That I really love, especially of Saturday Night Live. You have the horny mix.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, Mike Ross, which was the president of Delicious Vinyl, he was always he considers himself somewhat of a producer, and he's a creative guy. And so he was out there reaching out to different producers, trying to get remixes made. I wasn't a big remix guy. That wasn't my thing, like alternate mixes. But he actually did a good job of finding different producers out there who would do these remixes. And I think he was in the studio with some of these guys making some of these remixes. And so that was like one of the versions then, and people wound up liking it. So I had to give him credit.
Right. And you put it out on the Rarities collection.
Exactly.
You put it out a while back. And so I find it interesting that people thought you had an issue with California.
Yeah.
Because there's a real love for it. I think even on the Mad Ones, you even make a point of like shit saying, hey, this is how they talk in California. I'm sharing it with the East Coast.
What's the boy, the trouble with the C-Cypher power? In Cali, they call them one time, they be gaffling every hour, which means they be knocking. Good fellas, say your pitch. The skins are too tight. Baby doll, I got the wrench. I like the low riders with the Dayton's nice and shiny. If you're in the West, you got the best, you get the hiney. On the other hand, uptown at the Apollo. Chromed out with no tents and hammers, make them follow, but I never get.
So it seems to be a real act of kind of affection of wanting to share what's going on over there with the world.
I really was. I mean, you know, my attempt, you know, it was just like my version of what they were doing musically out there and down south, Brooklyn bass music or whatever, even though bass was more down south. But it was just trying to bring the coast together, show the similarities, and hopefully there could be some cultural exchange between the two coasts, because the divide was starting to be created at that time. You could start to see this divide in the industry of pick a side, kind of that was just starting at that time.
Right, and that would kind of come to a head on Born to Roll for you, at least a little bit.
For me, big time.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden I was, you know, pretty much across the boards embraced by the West Coast for the success of that record. And at the same time, in many ways, ostracized by my own hometown, you know, the East Coast in general, which felt that I was, quote unquote, a West Coast sellout because I was doing this record that was, in their eyes, sounded West Coast. I tried to explain in many interviews that, you know, the song that I sampled was actually an East Coast record.
Right, it was the original concept record.
Come around, they block with my cock diesel system and turn it up to 10 and then start to diss them. And they didn't want to battle if they did when they saw me. They'd open up their trunk, but they tried to ignore me. Hey, little suckers.
Original concept on Def Jam.
Yeah.
Russell Simmons was behind the record and everything. It was just a record that nobody had rapped on. And I rapped over it, and I knew that it would work in other markets, and I was right.
At what point did you realize that kind of feedback you were getting was just part of a larger schism between the coasts that was opening up at that point? Was that something you were conscious of then, or was it only
in
the late 90s you look back and you say,
I felt it. I knew that it was all happening right in front of me, you know, while I was traveling and doing these shows and getting this notoriety. The divide was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, I had a few, you know, fans come up to me in New York saying, yo, what's up with that West Coast stuff? Like, you know, you rocking with them now. You know, those are the kind of comments that I was getting on the street. And then, of course, the Source Awards and what happened with Suge Knight.
At the 1995 Source Awards, when coming on stage to accept the award, Above the Rim won for Motion Picture Soundtrack of the Year. Death Row Records CEO Suge Knight made the following comments, which were clearly meant to mock Bad Boy Head Puff Daddy.
Like to tell Tupac, keep his guards up, we ride with him. And one other thing I'd like to say, any artist out there want to be an artist and want to stay a star, and don't want to have to worry about the executive producer trying to be all in the video, all on the record, dancing, come to Death Row.
This was another escalation in the East Coast-West Coast feud that culminated in the deaths of Tupac Shakur and the Notorious B.I.G. over the following 18 months.
The whole Death Row and Bad Boy, like that, all of that stuff was happening like right in front of me. And you could see it. You could see it just taking shape.
Right. And one of the kickers, a sort of coda to this story, is probably 10 years, maybe a little less after that record, a guy comes out of New York City, in this case, Queens, and openly says on record that he sounds Southern.
I'm a New Yorker, but I sound Southern.
You know, 50 Cent goes 50 on Cent. To sell 10 million records.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you feel when that started happening? Because it's a template that you set in some ways.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I was happy for him. For me, it was like, oh, I was the West Coast sellout, but suddenly 10 years later, sounding like another region is acceptable and as a result, successful for other artists.
Getting back to the rapping for one second, on Slaughterhouse and a little bit on Sitting on Chrome, you use that, what you named on Slaughterhouse is like the offbeat, onbeat
yeah.
style.
I'm
gonna drop a new style of early MCs. I call this the offbeat, onbeat style. See if you can swing with it. See if you can swing with it. Go like this. It's the hippest, ready to rip it. My father dope is on the mic. It's not Ike and Tina Turner or Bob Hope. It's not that kid Ice Ice, baby, but I'm nice, nice. Confuse you and lose you when I'm saying words twice. I never quit rocking rhymes because I'm not yeah. a
woman. Where did that come from?
It didn't really come from anywhere. It was just one of those, I was always trying to do something different and come with flows that I thought were different than what cats were doing. I was just trying to always push the envelope. And so I unleashed this what I called the offbeat onbeat style at a release party, a Big Daddy Kane release party.
Right, snippet of which ends up on that record.
Yeah. That night was actually a pretty classic night. It was a huge freestyle session. You know, obviously Big Daddy Kane, but he brought up Nice and Smooth. He brought up Just Ice. He brought up a young Jay-Z.
So Jay-Z, if you're yo. Down with the staff, well, sit on the mic on my behalf.
Hey yo, as soon as I grab it, I eat it up like a savage. And no, I don't have it. I get it together like a marriage. I sing in the rappers. I'm on my P's, Q's, carrots. You don't understand? Well, goddamn, don't you know my status? Woo. I'm flowing the baddest. I'm the baddest. No need to explain. My name is the only thing that matters.
I was one of the people that got on the mic and spit Ill and Al Scratch. Ill from Ill and Al Scratch got up there as well. At the end. And so it was like a classic night. I'd say probably 15, 20 rappers got up there and spit over Impeach the President. And it was a great night. But for me, it was just about pushing the envelope, about coming up with some interesting punchlines that would wow people and make them go, ooh, ah, oh. And so that's what I did.
4 score and 7 years in the lab. And I know rap like Mike Tyson, those booty grabbing.
And Sitting on Chrome, you know, a lot of people love it. You know, it was just reissued and all this kind of stuff. But you've said in the past that you felt like it was dumbed down a little bit. Those are the words you've used to describe it. Looking back on it now, what are your feelings about that album, given all the compromises you had to make to get it made?
It's definitely my compromise album. That's the right way to put it. I did dumb down the lyrical content, the flow. You know, this record was done at a time when Dr. Dre's The Chronic was pretty much killing the whole game. It was like outsold everything and it was getting the most radio play. And so what I was trying to attempt to do there was, because what I was noticing was that the lyrics on Chronic weren't super complicated or hard to follow. And so fans were able to sing along with them more. So I said, well, let me, you know, see if I can come up with some really cool, interesting songs, where it's not overly lyrical, and maybe the fans will want to sing along and understand. Because I was at that from up to that point, I was trying to be super lyrical all the time, and so yeah, I did dumb down the flow a little bit, the lyrics a little bit. You know, Delicious Vinyl, my label at the time, they really asked me for that record.
Right, you said that it was kind of their influence that got you to start rhyming about car culture.
No, I started rhyming about car culture because that's what I was into. But because, you know, on Slaughterhouse album, Jeep Ass Nigga was the lead single.
I'm a Jeep Ass Nigga. Driving down the block like what else should a brother do? It's Saturday. The heat might smother you. Rolling down my window. Gee, I have an air conditioner. But I got the sound I want the whole world to listen to. Waiting at a red light. Kentucky Fried Chicken and blowing theory tape in. Bass crazy kicking in. See this Puerto Rican Latin.
So I was already rhyming about Jeeps and systems and cars and stuff. But then when Born to Roll, which is the same lyrics, all of a sudden blew up in a big way. And It started getting becoming really popular at these car shows. Delicious Vinyl, you know, asked me to basically do a record that would chase the success of that car culture audience. He's like, yeah, that's a big audience. If you get them behind you, you know, you're going to sell a lot of records. And can you give us a record that at least caters to that audience a little bit? And the result was the Sitting on Chrome album.
Interesting. And one final thing about that record. In the beginning of the song Freestyle, you mentioned, you know, the real meaning of the term freestyle.
This ain't off the top of the head, but it's still a freestyle. For those that know the real meaning.
That's what he's about to do.
One time for your mental zone, I'm prone. Direct this microphone, leave me alone. I'm in my...
This is, you know, something that I know Kane has talked about, you've talked about. What to you is the real meaning of the word freestyle?
Well, like I said on that record, on that snippet, it's just a rhyme. The day that I did the symphony verse, right? That was a rhyme that I just had memorized in my head. It wasn't for a song. It wasn't about anything specific. It was just me talking about being a dope rapper. And when we came up, asking somebody to spit a freestyle meant spit a dope rhyme. It didn't have a subject. It was just, I'm dope and this is why I'm dope. Later on, you know, when Supernatural and some of those other newer cats came out, I don't know exactly who decided that freestyling was, it had to be off the top of the head, but at some point that meaning changed. And I just wanted to let it be known that that wasn't the original meaning of what a freestyle was. It was just spit a rhyme. Memorized or off the head didn't matter as long as it was dope. So yeah, that's what it means to me. It always has meant to me. I do understand the new interpretation of it. I don't necessarily adhere to that. If I'm at a station and they say spit a freestyle, it could be written, it could be not written, but it's gonna be around.
Mm-hmm. And you had, you know, the B side on that album.
But the head rush funk to make it cars jump. Who got the pump when the tape start to pump? It's the incorporated.
It seemed like it was on its way to being a hit, and then something happened with it.
Yeah, the Brat and Jermaine Dupri drop a song called The B-Side.
The Notorious Big in the house. We got the Brat in the house. And me, y'all know who I be. Check it. I got beats and beats that you love to ride to. Funk for your trunk is what I provide you. So slide through your hood with me in your deck is your correct way to get your groove on. Bluffs and I paid the cost.
I'm like, man, we literally had just got added on Hot 97 with our song, The B-Side. And then, boom, Jermaine Dupri and the Brat dropped theirs. And our joint got taken off the air.
Yeah, it was just an awful, awful timing. So you had a bit of a time between that album and Disposable Arts. There was a good period there.
Yeah.
And in the beginning of Disposable Arts, you kind of refer to that as a jail sentence, right? You make the narrator of Disposable Arts was in jail for the same amount of time that you were had gone between albums.
Yep.
So tell us this. How does it feel to be coming out after all this time?
I mean, I was starting to think I wasn't never getting out of here, but I'm going to do things different this time. Believe me, I ain't never trying to come back here again.
What about that period felt like a jail sentence to you?
Well, not being able to express myself creatively was really, really what I was talking about. Just feeling like I was creatively kind of locked up, didn't have a label, didn't have really an outlet to put music out. And it just really was a sad time for me. I mean, I was instead of making music, I was making resumes. I was running around the music industry trying to get a job at a label. I was making beat tapes or beat CDs and passing them around at labels trying to get my name out there as a producer. That was the grind that I was on at that time. Really feeling like I wasn't going to probably do records again. And so that's why I, you know, use that as a metaphor for being in jail.
And you spent a good part of pretty much all of 97 and a good part of the year before working on stuff that never came out, right?
Yeah, it was. I was signed to Big Beat, Atlantic Records, same label as Artifacts, a few other artists. And they basically weren't happy with the musical direction that I was going in. This is at the height now of the Bad Boy success. You know, Puff Daddy and the family, and they were making, you know, all of these kind of R&B driven records that were getting tons and tons of radio play. And, you know, I remember at a particular creative meeting with the label with Atlantic, Craig Kalman and them, and, you know, it was kind of suggested that I get, you know, Carl Thomas maybe or Brian McKnight or Changing Faces to collaborate with me. And I considered it for a brief moment, but then really I didn't feel comfortable and I didn't want to do it. And I was like, why am I? I want the record to come out, but I'm forcing it. Like if I'm just throwing these R&B artists on these records, I'm forcing it. And so when I handed them the record that I felt was the record, didn't have those singers on it, and they just decided that they weren't going to put it out.
Mm-hmm. Do you still have those songs somewhere?
I still have them. Yeah, they're on DATs in my house. I listen to them. I've listened to them fairly recently, and when I listen to them, I could say that I'm kind of glad that they didn't come out, because I was doing what I felt I needed to do to stay signed lyrically. Some of the music was pretty cool, but it was definitely a lot more jiggy, if you will. A lot more shakers and hi-hats and, you know, trying to get people to dance a little bit more. And it wasn't what I was really about as an artist. I was doing it because I was trying to stay signed.
Yeah. And you had a couple things fall apart around that time. There was a Paula Perry record.
Yeah.
We had, you know, Lisa Cortez on the show who ran her label. And so we kind of got her perspective on that. Why do you think that the Queen of Fort Greene never quite blew up?
Well, because the label was closed. So, you know, I mean, like, there was a whole bunch of artists who were going to be signed and this and that. But after a very short amount of time, you know, after being told, well, we're going to make these changes. You know, it's hard when you have a small team and you go through a bigger label that has other priorities to gain traction.
What was that process like for you?
I mean, it just felt like a lot of hard work that just went to waste, you know. I put a lot into Paula Perry as an artist. Her first record that really got her buzzing was a song called Paula's Jam that I produced. Like, I literally got a DJ list and went to the post office with boxes and boxes of records, mailed them out myself to DJs. The record buzzed up. She got signed to, you know, Loose Cannon, Lisa Cortez label. And eventually that label got swallowed up by Mercury. She wound up on Mercury, and then Motown bought Mercury, and Mr. C was actually A&R in her record. Her and I's relationship by that time had kind of soured. I was still the executive producer on the record, but our relationship soured to the point that I wasn't even really going to her sessions anymore. Only her vocal sessions, but I wasn't really involved in the production of it. But I handed that over to Mr. C, who I knew would do a good job with it. And then at the final hour, when Motown bought Mercury, a guy over there who I thought I had a good relationship with, Kedar Massenburg, I asked him to have a meeting with me to talk about keeping Paula Perry signed and putting the record out. And he actually showed me what an industry friend was by basically abandoning the opportunity to have a sit down with me. You know, this is a guy who Daddy-O's brother, who I felt like I had a, once I knew he was in charge of Motown, I thought, well, I'm good, because I got me and Keto are cool like that. But he didn't even give me the respect to have a sit down meeting with me. And, you know, t- I carry that with me to this day. I have hard feelings about that. So because of that, because they dropped her, you know, her career basically ended at that point.
Right. And so you, after this period, you released Disposable Arts, which is a record that kind of gave you a second life in a way.
It did.
Yeah.
Disposable Arts is my most important record for me personally as an artist. It's my favorite record of mine that I made, because it was made in a time where, after being signed to these labels and being told the type of music I needed to make, I felt like for the first time, I was going to do the exact record that I wanted to do. And I didn't want to hear any outside influences from anybody. And I was allowed to do that. And the result was a record that essentially extended my career another 10 years. That more than that now, going on 15 years. But when that record came out in 01, I didn't realize it at the time, but it garnered me a whole new legion of fans that were 16 and 17 and 18 years old that were hearing that record, didn't know anything about the first three records, didn't know who I was before that record. And a lot of those fans were actually overseas in Europe. And that began my my really long-standing relationship with the European fans and touring over there.
Mm-hmm. And touring in general, I think you are, you know, one of the more hard-touring artists out there, you know, even in domestic markets. You know, there's a regular listener to the show who lives in Vermont, and he said, oh, you know, Ace plays Burlington more often than some local bands. You know, I've seen him three or four times in the past year.
I've been up there like three times. Yeah. That's a testament to the music, I think. The fact that promoters, you know, want to book you, especially, you know, promoters in the States, they're not the same in Europe. The money's different. They just don't have the money. And it's tough for them because, you know, the U.S. market is sort of driven by radio and video and popularity on a commercial level. And if it's not there, promoters are usually reluctant. But some of the promoters that are actually true fans of what I've been doing musically, they book me knowing that they're going to lose their shirt and knowing that, you know, they're not going to probably make much of anything on the show just because they feel like they want me in front of the fans in their city. And that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm. So Disposable Arts, you know, is you've done records that wound together before where Skits connected stuff before. But to my ear, at least, Disposable Arts is the first true concept record, I think, that you've done. You know, Sitting on Chrome kind of hints at it. They're recurring characters, but
yep.
Disposable Arts is the first real story. But you've done other kinds of writing before. Didn't you write a short story in the Source, or a piece in the Source about graffiti?
I did one called Sleeping Snakes that was in the Source. I've done a piece for Vibe as well. But Sleeping Snakes was actually a short that I wrote when I was in college. And I basically took that and sort of reworked it and gave it to the Source. But I've done stuff for Vibe. There's like one or two other magazines I've done stuff for. I've always been a writer, man, since high school, really, creative writer. Just that the, you know, writing those kind of things don't really make the money, but, you know, music a little more lucrative. But I see myself expanding my writing endeavors into TV and possibly Broadway and things of that nature. I definitely have my sights set on some higher ground.
Excellent. So on Disposable Arts, you have that Unfriendly Game tune, which is a song length metaphor talking about, at this one and the same time, drug dealing and football.
Yeah.
'Cause no matter the weather, the game don't stop. Competing with other teams, the rain on top. Your offense gotta be cats with no conscience. No nonsense niggas with no options. They know how to carry that rock. Make the handoff and run off the block. It's hard to get.
I've always been curious about those kinds of songs. How difficult is it for you to write something where every line has to work two ways?
It's fun. That's the joy of writing for me. Those, you know, double entendre type songs, the double meaning songs. That's what I get excited about. I could write a straight rap and just talk about being dope, but that's kind of gets boring after a while. But the challenge of you know, like the song, you know, Alphabet Soup is another one, where I said, okay, I'm going to take the letters of the alphabet and I'm going to tell a story using each letter from A to Z in order, and tell a cohesive story and tell it in a way where you may not even hear every alphabet, but it's there.
Hey, son, how you be?
Hey, yo, I'm chillin'.
And I see you D to go out and make a killin', but where E?
F that nigga, he making G's on tour with H-Town, doing shows overseas.
Yeah, I heard he DJ.
To me, way more fun than just writing a straight battle verse, if you will. And to me, more creative. And I just always been that rapper that's tried to be better than my peers. Who some don't want to push the envelope. I'm that guy that's going to just try to do something that has it, that I haven't heard anybody else do.
And the central song on that record, I think the most popular one and kind of, you know, important thematically as well, is Dear Diary.
Don't ever again show your face on a stage or write the name Master Ace on a page. Kid, you're done. Whoever let you back in the door should get a smack in the jaw, because you sure shouldn't be rapping no more.
Nope.
You already proved that at the Lyricist Lounge Affair, trying to battle with rhymes you wrote on the way there. Maybe next time.
What inspired you to write such a self-critical song?
I wrote that song after I'd had that the battle with Boogeyman on stage at B.B. King's. I was pretty mad at myself about even allowing myself to get in that situation. And so it was easy for me to write that song from a perspective of being angry at myself, because that was something that I could have easily avoided, I could have played that differently. But sometimes, you know, ego and you know, machoism get you caught up in the moment and you make a decision that's not a wise decision. And so I was mad at myself. And Dear Diary, that was a beat that Domingo had for a while. And I wasn't going to do anything with it until that incident happened. And then that was immediately the song that I ran to.
Take us back to the day of that battle for a second, the Boogeyman mm-hmm. battle. First off, for those who haven't seen the tape, it's obvious that he prepared a whole bunch of stuff.
I should thank you, dude. You brought it to life. It's because of you, now I know exactly what stupid sound like. Blame your fans. Blame your fans. They should have told you the blinds. They sound like how the fry green eggs and ham. I just do not understand. I hope you was freestyling. If not, your brain should have beef with your hands. You wrote that down?
Yeah.
And you were, you know, going off the top of the head.
You're the type of rapper I label as so-so. Cause every time you put out a record, we like, so? When I ask cast if they heard of you, they like, oh, that's that nigga who made that, no. You on stage frontin' like you think you a star. Now these percent of these people don't know who the fuck you are.
Why did you decide not to prepare for that? Or was that even really a decision?
Because that wasn't supposed to happen. There wasn't a battle scheduled.
Really? Because in the video, it looks like, oh, it's this giant thing. Ice-T is hosting.
I know. It had nothing. He was hosting a show that Big Daddy Kane was performing on, but the battle part was not planned. The only thing that was planned was that I was going to do my verse to acknowledge about him during Kane's set.
Yeah, I heard of the Boogeyman when I was a youth. Scary. Then I found out that he was as fake as a tooth fairy. Since my last mission, this nigga been ass-kissing. I took a minute. I gave your single a fast listen. Tell me this. And no pot to pissin'. How you dissing? Your group home's about to be reporting you missing. And now I don't know what was worse. The track or the verse. I'ma get to your producer, but I'm smacking you first. See, I couldn't even...
And I came out. Kane allowed me to do that. And then I was supposed to leave the stage and be done. I did the verse. People went crazy. They were like, they couldn't believe the rhymes that I said. The lines were, every line hit home. And that was supposed to be the end of it. Because earlier in the night, I guess he had been on stage and he had said some stuff about me on stage, mm-hmm. rapped about me. And so
you think like, okay, it's fair. You know,
yeah, this is my answer to what he did.
Right.
But then after all that was over and things ended on a great note, Ice-T egged on, you know, two rappers got a beef. They got to settle it old school style on stage. And this is what, you know. And so he called me back out. And the moment, whether I was prepared or not, the moment wouldn't allow me to just stay backstage and not come out. And, you know, that's probably The only thing I regret is I could have just been like, nope, I said what I had to say. Y'all heard it. Y'all went crazy, and I don't got nothing else to say. Going up there unprepared was a bad idea.
What was it like when you first realized, oh man, he's got, you know, three verses ready to just about of stuff about me?
Yeah, I mean, it was all kind of surreal. It I don't really have much memory of that day. It kind of happened. I knew it was going bad as it was happening. And it's almost like being in a car accident and the car is spinning and you're like, oh shit, this is not, but I can't stop it. I'm going to crash and this is what it is. But I was able to, you know, bounce back from that situation. That was as low as I was going to ever go. I knew that much. And when you're a resilient person, you know, in those moments, you say, okay, well, now what do you do? Do you crumble or do you rise up above? And I've had, you know, the 10 years, the 15 years almost that followed that night have been really the best in my career.
Right. And you got, you know, one of your best loved songs out of it too.
Yeah.
So with EMC, you had performed on a tour, the members kind of separately and so forth. But what really bonded you as a group was a trip to Europe you took in 2001.
Yeah.
And I was curious about that because the timing of that is you guys left the United States to go to Europe right after 9/11.
No, literally. We our flight left on September 23rd.
So probably the soonest you could take a flight.
Yeah. Because the airports were shut down for over a week.
Yeah.
So September 23rd was our flight to Europe. And when we took off from JFK, we could still see the World Trade Center smoke and everything. It was a difficult decision, definitely for Words, because his now wife, girlfriend at the time, was pregnant with their first child. And she was super concerned about him going on the road. He was really close to backing out of going on that tour. And, you know, we had already promoted that Punch and Words were going to be opening up and they were on the flyers and everything. And so it took a long, hard conversation with them to convince. I had to convince them to come on the tour. Strickland was on the phone as well, and he, you know, his point was, this is probably the safest time to fly, you know, because of all of the checks and balances and everything that's going to be going on. So we got on that plane. We actually flew, funny enough, we flew Air India, which added a little bit of tension to the process. We were on a 747, which holds somewhere around 500 people. And I want to say there was 35, 40 people on the entire flight. It was really weird.
Wow.
It was really weird. There was a point on that flight when I hadn't seen a flight attendant for about an hour, and I started getting concerned. And I got up and started walking around the plane looking for flight attendants, couldn't find anybody. And then I went all the way to the front, and they were all in this little galley just talking or whatever. And I didn't say anything. I was like, what the hell are you doing? Like, walk around. Like, I want to see some movement. But we landed safely, obviously, and that tour sparked the relationship. Us being on that tour, we did 22 shows in about 26 days, 28 days.
And what was it like being an American in Europe at that point?
I mean, the shows were incredible because every other U.S. artist canceled their tour. All the tours canceled. We were the only tour that went out. And so people were just so happy that we came over to do the tour with everything going on in the world. So there was almost like a rejoicing of when we came on the stage because, you know, there wasn't going to be any touring in Europe at all that year.
Right. Wow. And getting back to the records for a second, is it true that Soda and Soap, the song from Long Hot Summer, was supposed to be a Will Smith record originally?
Yeah, I wrote that for Will Smith to a completely different beat. I have these CDs that I put out called Hits You Missed. So the original version that I laid down for Will Smith to that beat is actually on one of the hits you missed. I think it's volume 5. The premixes.
She had a lot of Pepsi, honey was peace. And she told me she liked my smile like Shanice. She danced at this club and made the guys holler. And in a minute made like $1,000. A club that was run by Mr. Schweppes. He had a rep and everybody watched they step.
Yeah, it was written for Will. It was during the time he was working on his Willennium album. Jazzy Jeff had me come out as a writer. I was out there with Common was another person out there writing for him. A guy named Kel Spencer from Brooklyn, and we were all writing songs for him. I wrote Soda and Soap. I wrote a couple other things. But that particular joint was a full joint that he decided not to use. I think it was just, for him, I think it was too, it was going to be too obvious that he didn't write this or whatever. I don't know what it is. I never got the explanation as to why he did, passed on the song, but, you know, it just, he didn't feel like it was his style, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so I had put this work in to make this record that I thought was a dope record, and I decided that, well, I might as well use it for myself.
She had a lot of Pepsi, honey was peace, and she told me she liked my smile like Shanice. She danced at this club and made the guys holler, and in a minute made like $1,000. A club that was run by Mr. Schweppes, he had a rep, and everybody watched their step.
Timing worked out beautifully.
Absolutely. You know, talking about writing for Will Smith and being in a situation where people are kind of making these records for other artists, obviously the idea of ghostwriting or writing for other people or whatever is kind of has been a big topic lately.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Because to me, it kind of seems like fans who maybe don't know how stuff works are kind of jumping into the middle of a conversation, and people don't necessarily know the difference between writing for someone and ghostwriting and collaborating and, you know, throwing ideas around in a studio and so forth. Like, what's your take on the current conversation around, you know, ghostwriting, for lack of a better word?
Well, from the perspective of Will Smith, at that point, he's already a huge box office movie star. Like, he's legitimately a movie star. He's not considered a rapper anymore, but he still has rap fans. So for him, it was almost like, okay, I still like music, so let's do this. But he's not taking it seriously enough to be sitting down there writing rhymes. So I completely understood, you know, that perspective. And for what it's worth, the writing sessions that we had together, me, him, Kel Spencer, all in a room together, and just throwing lines out. And that we pieced together an entire song by everybody just contributing lines. And Will contributed lines as well.
Ace is likely talking here about the song which features Spencer and on which Ace is credited as a writer along with Smith.
Been to the mountaintop, down to the valley, Philadelphia, Cali, y'all feel me like Harry felt Sally. Clothes exotic, flows erotic, no jewels, that's for them fools who ain't got it.
Sometimes that's how songs are made, but from a bigger perspective, some of the most classic hip-hop records were written by other people. And you either like the song or you don't like the song. As long as we're not getting into a space of talking about lyricism and this artist is a true lyricist and they're the best rapper. Or if we're just talking about making song making, I completely understand that some of these artists want to get other people to help them do songs. You know, Will Smith's song Summertime was written by Rakim. If you listen to the flow on the song, you'll realize that Rakim wrote the song.
Here it is, a groove slightly transformed, just a bit of a break from the norm, just a little something to break the monotony of all that hardcore dance that has got. Standing by the speaker, suddenly I had this fever, wasn't me or either, summer madness. Cause I just can't stand around, so I get closer, and the closer I get, the better it sounds. My mind starts to act.
This been happening for ever. Like, this is part of history, you know. Salt and Pepper didn't write their whole first album. They wrote some of it, but they got help, you know what I'm saying? So some of our, what we consider heroes, you know, in hip-hop had help. Not the Rakims or the Big Daddy Kanes of the world, but some of the other artists out there that aren't in that category of lyricists or, you know, best MC. They had help making songs. We're doing songs, man. It's songs.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to write for some of these guys.
Yeah. Well, you know, Will Smith ever does a follow-up, make it happen.
I mean, Diddy sold 7 million records. I don't think he wrote any of the rhymes on that album.
Yeah, definitely. So one kind of hidden corner of your catalog that I really loved is the record you did with Ed OG.
Arts and Entertainment.
Hey, yo, Arts and Entertainment is the acronym for these two amazing American Africans. This is adverb aerobics like we at the gym. Alternating on these verses, I go after him. Yeah.
Edo earned everything far from easily, equal to Ace, so we split the pie up evenly. I stay fly like Amelia Earhart, eclipse any MC within an earshot. Hey, yo, I got a...
How would you describe your and Ed's styles? Like, how do they work together?
I mean, Ed is a, he's a rapper's rapper. He's very good at what he does. He knows what his lyrical lane is. He found that, you know, years ago. He stays in that lane. He's consistent. Every verse is always going to be on point and it's equally as good as the next. He's not a big concept writer, but he always going to give you a good verse with some clever stuff in it. And, you know, that's what I've always enjoyed about him. As an artist, when we came together to put the record together, it was a little bit tricky because we didn't really know how to create this working relationship. We had been on songs together. We had been on about 4 or 5 different songs together, but they were usually put together by a third party who asked Ed OG for a verse and then turned around and asked me for a verse or vice versa. And so we wound up on these songs together, but, you know, actually going in and making songs together was a tricky proposition, but we respected and trusted each other's craft enough to say, well, I know whatever he puts down is going to be dope. I just got to make sure mine is dope too. And that's pretty much how it went.
And on Pass the Mic on that record, there's this idea of rap as a whole is kind of like a giant conversation.
We don't call these verses, these are conversations between us and the whole congregation. I mean, every cat that ever tried to rap, the whole rhyme nation.
And I thought that was such an awesome idea and something that, like, I've always kind of thought, even if I didn't quite have the words to describe it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
First of all, it was just great collaborating with KRS-One. Both of us were excited about that. Neither one of us had ever collaborated with him. We both list him as an influence. It was an easy record to make and to write because it wasn't that much of a workload. You got 3 different rappers on the song, so we had to write really small portions of the song. KRS just elevated the song with his voice, with what he brings to the table. I don't know. I just wanted to make sure whatever I spit was going to be worthy to be on a record with KRS-One. That's kind of how I was approaching it.
Nice. And so we are talking only a few days after the release of Straight Outta Compton, the NWA movie.
Yeah.
You have a little bit of history with that film's director.
I do. F. Gary Gray directed Jeep Ass Nigga for me. He also directed
Saturday Night Live
for me. That was when he was like really just starting out as a video director, just like trying to get on the map. Obviously he's done bigger and greater and better things since then, but you know, I'm happy to be part of his history, his discography, if you will, in the early days.
Yeah. And you know, you did this True Hip Hop Stories video a little while back about the symphony.
Yeah.
Where you talked about, you know, your memories of the symphony and so forth.
I wasn't supposed to be on that record. The original lineup for that record was supposed to be Big Daddy Kane, Kool G Rap, Craig G, MC Shan. A lot of people don't know that. Marley collected everybody, and he said that he wanted to go to his crib in Astoria, Queens, and do this record, the last record for the album. And Shan was supposed to be one of the MCs. Well, MC Shan basically said, you know, to Marley that he felt like, he said this on the side, but Marley told us later what went down. He was like, that he felt like he planned himself to be on a record with all these new jacks. At that point, Kane didn't have no album out, G-Rap no album, Craig no album.
And he just felt it set off a little, interesting little back and forth where Shan made a response.
But see, what y'all gotta understand is I knew Marley Marl, and I've done songs with him and that I didn't get paid for. And so I can understand Ace for listening to that crap Marley was telling him. But if y'all know me, I was never one to say nothing on the side behind your back. If I felt something about you, I was gonna say it to your face. So it was never a thing of me saying to Marley, oh, I don't wanna be on that record with them new jacks.
And then Marley made a response video to Shen's response.
But to be honest, who really gives a fuck? Who cares? It's like 25 years ago. Master Ace made that video like 4 years ago. You have 4 years to say something. And nobody said nothing. It's so funny. And as to Cold Chillin', you know nobody was getting paid back in the day. We was making joints. This is what it was.
It was kind of a whole big thing. Were you surprised that all happened?
Oh, I was definitely surprised. I didn't think that it needed to go anywhere near as far as it went. But, you know, Shan wanted to give his perspective on it. And he has a perspective because nobody was actually there except him and Marley when they had the conversation about him coming to the studio. All I know is what I was told. So all I could do was tell the story from my perspective, which is Marley came over and said, the reason Shan's not going to be on the song is because he doesn't want to be on the song with a bunch of new jacks. Whether he actually said those exact words or maybe Marley interpreted what he said in that way. But, you know, I think Shan was just trying to get his point of view out there. And, you know, Marley got his point of view out there and nobody cared, honestly. Nobody cared about any of it. It's all good.
Okay. And, you know, finally, what are you up to right now? Obviously, you know, I just saw EMC perform this summer.
Yeah.
What's going on with you?
Well, when I leave you, I'm actually going to the studio. I'm in the studio diligently working on my next solo effort, and it'll be out end of this year or top of next year. It's an album that is going to take you back to my 4 years of high school. So it's another period piece.
Interesting. Following up on the M.A. Doom album, which was about your childhood and your relationship with your mother.
Exactly. So M.A. Doom dealt with me kind of being in junior high school age. So this is like the bigger continuation of that life story. So it takes you back, going to take you back to my high school years and tell really the story of me throughout those 4 years of high school and what was going on around my life, around my neighborhood, around being in high school, and the stuff that I was dealing with as a about to be young man. The whole entire album is produced by a cat named Kick Beats, who is out of L.A., who's a super talented dude. He produced two songs on the EMC album, The Tonight Show. He produced a song called Scientology and another song called Fly Thoughts. Super talented dude, musician. I mean, he does it all. We got about 15 songs done so far. Not done, but written and laid down. Bringing collaborators in, artists in to feature on some songs. Hopefully going to have AG on a song. Rock Marciano on a song. Already have Torre on a record. And Your Old Droog is on a record. I'm just excited about this album. I haven't revealed the title yet. And I think now is a good time to do that on your show. The name of the album is going to be called The Falling Season, and it's coming out very, very soon.
Excellent. Really, really excited to hear that. Finally, what's it been like for you these last two projects to like take pieces of your life and your memories and sort of put them back out as art?
It's therapeutic. It's helped me deal with the death of my grandmother and my mother. It allows me to go back in time and relive days when they were still alive and life was good and great. And it allows me to give people a little glimpses of who they were on this earth and how important they were to me and my life and my upbringing. And I'm looking forward to people hearing this record and hearing more about that.
Well, thank you so much, Master Ace, Ace One.
It's a lot of different ones.
A lot of different names. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
It was just an accident of timing that I happened to see Ace perform with EMC and with the Juice Crew at Central Park a little bit before our interview. But it was a lucky one. Seeing that show made me understand how much energy and care he puts into his performances, which is something that has kept his career going to this day. I was glad also to get Ace's take on East Coast-West Coast tensions, and how, as someone who was in a way between the camps, he saw those tensions beginning to brew several years before they would erupt publicly. But most importantly, I'm glad we got to get a look into the process of a great writer. It's not a coincidence that most of Ace's recent releases have been concept albums. His gift for narrative is almost as strong as his knack for wordplay. Join us next week for a special two-part episode. We'll talk with Nico Iz, the talented and versatile Florida by way of Brazil artist, who recently caught the attention of no less than Talib Kweli, who signed Nico to his Javodi Media label. And we also catch up with Beige One of the long-running underground group Junk Science. As I mentioned, make sure you subscribe to The Cipher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecipher show. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at The Cipher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cipher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
It was a sad time for me.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Well, back then we called it scheming.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He's not a big concept writer, but he's always going to give you a good verse.
Special thanks to our biggest Patreon supporter, Vikram.
And we were all writing songs for him.
We'll see you next time around on The Cipher.
Now, like, easy, buddy. Come take a picture.